A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Random House Audio presents Star Wars Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, by Matthew Stover, based on the story and screenplay by George Lucas, read for you by Jonathan Davis. This story happened a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. It is already over. Nothing can be done to change it. It is a story of love and loss, brotherhood and betrayal, courage and sacrifice and the death of dreams. It is a story of the blurred line between our best and our worst. It is the story of the end of an age. A strange thing about stories. Though this all happened so long ago and so far away that words cannot describe the time or the distance, it is also happening right now, right here. It is happening as you listen to these words. This is how 25 millennia come to a close. Corruption and treachery have crushed 1,000 years of peace. This is not just the end of a republic. Night is falling on civilization itself. This is the twilight of the Jedi. The end starts now. Introduction. The Age of Heroes. The skies of Coruscant blaze with war. The artificial daylight spread by the capital's orbital mirrors is sliced by intersecting flames of ion drives and punctuated by starburst explosions. Contrails of debris raining into the atmosphere become tangled ribbons of cloud. The nightside sky is an infinite lattice of shining hairlines that interlock planetoids and track erratic spirals of glowing gnats. Beings watching from rooftops of Coruscant's endless cityscape can find it beautiful. From the inside, it's different. The gnats are drive glows of starfighters. The shining hairlines are light scatter from turbo laser bolts powerful enough to vaporize a small town. The planetoids are capital ships. The battle from the inside is a storm of confusion and panic, of galvaned particle beams flashing past your starfighter so close that your cockpit rings like a broken annunciator, of the boot-sole shock of concussion missiles that blast into your cruiser, killing beings you have trained with and eaten with and played and laughed and bickered with. From the inside, the battle is desperation and terror and the stomach-churning certainty that the whole galaxy is trying to kill you. Across the remnants of the Republic, stunned beings watch in horror as the battle unfolds live on the HoloNet. Everyone knows the war has been going badly. Everyone knows that more Jedi are killed or captured every day, that the Grand Army of the Republic has been pushed out of system after system. But this, a strike at the very heart of the Republic? An invasion of Coruscant itself? How can this happen? It's a nightmare, and no one can wake up. Live via HoloNet, beings watch the separatist droid army flood the government district. The coverage is filled with images of overmatched clone troopers cut down by remorselessly powerful destroyer droids in the halls of the Galactic Senate itself. A gasp of relief. The troopers seem to beat back the attack. There are hugs and even some quiet cheers in living rooms across the galaxy as the separatist forces retreat to their landers and streak for orbit. We won, beings tell each other. We held them off. But then, new reports trickle in, only rumors at first, that the attack wasn't an invasion at all, that the separatists weren't trying to take the planet, that this was a lightning raid on the Senate itself. The nightmare gets worse. The Supreme Chancellor is missing. Palpatine of Naboo, the most admired man in the galaxy, whose unmatched political skills have held the Republic together, whose personal integrity and courage prove that the separatist propaganda of corruption in the Senate is nothing but lies, whose charismatic leadership gives the whole Republic the will to fight on. Palpatine is more than respected. He is loved. Even the rumor of his disappearance strikes a dagger to the heart of every friend of the Republic. Every one of them knows it in her heart, in his gut, in its very bones. Without Palpatine, the Republic will fall. And now confirmation comes through, and the news is worse than anyone could have imagined. Supreme Chancellor Palpatine has been captured by the Separatists, and not just the Separatists. He's in the hands of General Grievous. Grievous is not like the other leaders of the Separatists. Newt Gunray is treacherous and venal, but he's Nymoidian. Venality and treachery are expected, and in the Chancellor of the Trade Federation, there are even virtues. Poggle the Lesser is Archduke of the Weapon Masters of Geonosis, where the war began. He is analytical and pitiless, but also pragmatic, reasonable. The political heart of the Separatist Confederacy, Count Dooku, is known for his integrity, his principled stand against what he sees as corruption in the Senate. Though they believe he's wrong, many respect him for the courage of his mistaken convictions. These are hard beings, dangerous beings, ruthless and aggressive. General Grievous, though, Grievous is a monster. The Separatist Supreme Commander is an abomination of nature, a fusion of flesh and droid, and his droid parts have more compassion than what remains of his alien flesh. This half-living creature is a slaughterer of billions. Whole planets have burned at his command. He is the evil genius of the Confederacy, the architect of their victories, the author of their atrocities. And his Durasteel grip has closed upon Palpatine. He confirms the capture personally in a wideband transmission from his command cruiser in the midst of the orbital battle. Beings across the galaxy watch and shudder and pray that they might wake up from this awful dream. Because they know that what they're watching live on the holonet is the death of the Republic. Many among these beings break into tears. Many more reach out to comfort their husbands or wives, their creshmates or kin triads, and their younglings of all descriptions, from children to cubs to spawn fry. But here is a strange thing. Few of the younglings need comfort. It is instead the younglings who offer comfort to their elders. Across the Republic, in words or pheromones, in magnetic pulses, tentacle braids, or mental telepathy, the message from the younglings is the same. Don't worry. It'll be all right. Anakin and Obi-Wan will be there any minute. They say this as though these names can conjure miracles. Anakin and Obi-Wan. Kenobi and Skywalker. From the beginning of the Clone Wars, the phrase Kenobi and Skywalker has become a single word. They are everywhere. Holonet features of their operations against the Separatist enemy have made them the most famous Jedi in the galaxy. Younglings across the galaxy know their names, know everything about them, follow their exploits as though they are sports heroes instead of warriors in a desperate battle to save civilization. Even grown-ups are not immune. It's not uncommon for an exasperated parent to ask, when faced with offspring, who have just tried to pull off one of the spectacularly dangerous bits of foolishness that are the stock in trade of high-spirited younglings everywhere, "So which were you supposed to be, Kenobi or Skywalker?" Kenobi would rather talk than fight, but when there is fighting to be done, few can match him. Skywalker is the master of audacity. His intensity, boldness, and sheer jaw-dropping luck are the perfect complement to Kenobi's deliberate, balanced steadiness. Together, they are a Jedi hammer that has crushed Separatist infestations on scores of worlds. All the younglings watching the battle in Coruscant Sky know it. When Anakin and Obi-Wan get there, those dirty Seppers are going to wish they'd stayed in bed today. The adults know better, of course. That's part of what being a grown-up is, understanding that heroes are created by the Holonet, and that the real-life Kenobi and Skywalker are only human beings after all. Even if they really are everything the legends say they are, who's to say they'll show up in time? Who knows where they are right now? They might be trapped on some Separatist backwater. They might be captured or wounded, even dead. Some of the adults even whisper to themselves, they might have fallen. Because the stories are out there. Not on the HoloNet, of course. The HoloNet news is under the control of the Office of the Supreme Chancellor, and not even Palpatine's renowned candor would allow tales like these to be told. But people hear whispers. Whispers of names that the Jedi would like to pretend never existed. Sora Bulk. Deepa Balaba. Jedi who have fallen to the dark. Who have joined the Separatists, or worse. Who have massacred civilians, or even murdered their comrades. The adults have a sickening suspicion that Jedi cannot be trusted. Not anymore. That even the greatest of them can suddenly just snap. The adults know that legendary heroes are merely legends, and not heroes at all. These adults can take no comfort from their younglings. Palpatine is captured. Grievous will escape. The Republic will fall. No mere human beings can turn this tide. No mere human beings would even try. Not even Kenobi and Skywalker. And so it is that these adults across the galaxy watch the HoloNet with ashes where their heart should be. Ashes because they can't see two prismatic bursts of real space reversion far out beyond the planet's gravity well. Because they can't see a pair of starfighters crisply jettison hyperdrive rings and streak into the storm of Separatist vulture fighters with all guns blazing. A pair of starfighters. Jedi starfighters. Only two. Two is enough. Two is enough because the adults are wrong and their younglings are right. Though this is the end of the Age of Heroes, it has saved its best for last. Chapter 1. Anakin and Obi-Wan. Anti-fighter flak flashed on all sides. Even louder than the clatter of shrapnel and the snarl of his sublight drives, his cockpit hummed and rang with near hits from the turbo laser fire of the capital ships crowding space around him. Sometimes his whirling, spinning dive through the cloud of battle skimmed bursts so closely that the energy scatter would slam his starfighter hard enough to bounce his head off the supports of his pilot's chair. Right now, Obi-Wan Kenobi envied the clones. At least they had helmets. R4, he said on internal comm. Can't you do something with the inertials? The droid, ganged into the socket on his starfighter's left wing, whistled something that sounded suspiciously like a human apology. Obi-Wan's frown deepened. R4-P17 had been spending too much time with Anakin's eccentric astromech. It was picking up R2-D2's bad habits. New bursts of flak bracketed his path. He reached into the Force, feeling for a safe channel through the swarms of shrapnel and sizzling nets of particle beams. There wasn't one. He locked a snarl behind his teeth, twisting his starfighter around another explosion that could have peeled its armor like an overripe Ithorian starfruit. He hated this part. Hated it. Flying's for droids. His cockpit speakers crackled. There isn't a droid made that can outfly you, Master. He could still be surprised by the new depth of that voice. The calm confidence. The maturity. It seemed that only last week, Anakin had been a 10-year-old who wouldn't stop pestering him about Form 1 lightsaber combat. Sorry, he muttered, kicking into a dive that slipped a turbo laser burst by no more than a meter. Was that out loud?
Wouldn't matter if it wasn't. I know what you're thinking.
Do you? He looked up through the cockpit canopy to find his one-time Padawan flying inverted, mirroring him so closely that but for the transparent steel between them, they might have shaken hands. Obi-Wan smiled up at him. Some new gift of the Force?
Not the Force, Master. Experience. That's what you're always thinking.
Obi-Wan kept hoping to hear some of Anakin's old cocky grin in his tone, but he never did. Not since Jabim. Perhaps not since Geonosis. The war had burned it out of him. Obi-Wan still tried, now and again, to spark a real smile in his former Padawan, and Anakin still tried to answer.
They both still tried to pretend the war hadn't changed them. Ah. Obi-Wan took a hand from the starfighter's control yoke to direct his upside-down friend's attention forward. Dead ahead, a blue-white point of light splintered into four laser-straight trails of ion drives. And what does experience tell you we should do about those incoming tri-fighters?
That we should break right!
Obi-Wan was already making that exact move as Anakin spoke. But they were inverted to each other. Breaking right shot him one way while Anakin whipped the other. The tri-fighters' cannons ripped space between them, tracking faster than their starfighters could slip. His onboard threat display chimed a warning. Two of the droids had remote sensor locks on him. The others must have lit up his partner. Anakin, slip jaws.
My thought exactly.
They blew past the tri-fighters, looping in a vase of spirals. The droid ships wrenched themselves into pursuit maneuvers that would have killed any living pilot. The slip jaws maneuver was named for the scissor-like mandibles of the Kashyyyk slash spider. Droids closing rapidly on their tails, cannon fire stitching space on all sides, the two Jedi pulled their ships through perfectly mirrored rolls that sent them streaking head-on for each other from opposite ends of a vast Republic cruiser. For merely human pilots, this would be suicide. By the time you can see your partner starfighter streaking toward you at a respectable fraction of light speed, it's already too late for your merely human reflexes to react. But these particular pilots were far from merely human. The Force nudged hands on control yokes, and the Jedi starfighters twisted and flashed past each other belly to belly, close enough to scorch each other's paint. Tri-fighters were the Trade Federation's latest space superiority droid. But even the electronic reflexes of the Tri-Fighter's droid brains were too slow for this. One of his pursuers met one of Anakin's head-on. Both vanished in a blossom of flame. The shockwave of debris and expanding gas rocked Obi-Wan. He fought the control yoke, barely keeping his starfighter out of a tumble that would have smeared him across the cruiser's ventral hull. Before he could straighten out, his threat display chimed again. Oh, marvelous, he muttered under his breath. Anakin's surviving pursuer had switched targets. Why is it always me?
Perfect.
Through the cockpit speakers, Anakin's voice carried grim satisfaction.
Both of them are on your tail.
Perfect is not the word I'd use. Obi-Wan twisted his yoke, juking madly as space around him flared scarlet.
We have to split them up.
Break left.
Anakin sounded calm as a stone.
The turbo laser tower off your port bow. Thread its guns. I'll take things from there.
Easy for you to say. Obi-Wan whipped sideways along the cruiser's superstructure. Fire from the pursuing tri-fighters blasted burning chunks from the cruiser's armor. Why am I always the bait?
I'm right behind you. R2, lock on.
Obi-Wan spun his starfighter between the recoiling turbo cannons, close enough that energy scatter made his cockpit clang like a gong. But still, cannon fire flashed past him from the tri-fighters behind.
Anakin, they're all over me!
Dead ahead. Move right to clear my shot. Now!
Obi-Wan flared his port jets, and the starfighter kicked to the right. One of the tri-fighters behind him decided it couldn't follow and went for a ventral slip that took it directly into the blasts from Anakin's cannons. It vanished in a boil of superheated gas.
Good shooting, R2.
Anakin's dry chuckle in the cockpit speakers vanished behind the clang of lasers blasting a blade of shielding off Obi-Wan's left wing.
I'm running out of tricks here.
Clearing the vast Republic cruiser put him on course for the curving hull of one of the Trade Federation's battleships. Space between the two capital ships blazed with turbolaser exchanges. Some of those flashing energy blasts were as big around as his entire ship. The merest graze would blow him to atoms. Obi-Wan dived right in. He had the Force to guide him through, and the Tri-Fighter had only its electronic reflexes. But those electronic reflexes operated at roughly the speed of light. It stayed on his trail as if he were dragging it by a tow cable. When Obi-Wan went left and Anakin right, the Tri-Fighter would swing halfway through the difference. The same with up and down. It was averaging his movements with Anakin's. Somehow, its droid brain had realized
that as long as it stayed between the two Jedi, Anakin couldn't fire on it without hitting his partner. The Tri-Fighter was under no similar restraint. Obi-Wan flew through a storm of scarlet needles. "No wonder we're losing the war," he muttered. "They're getting smarter."
"What was that, Master? I didn't copy."
Obi-Wan kicked his starfighter into a tight spiral toward the Federation cruiser. "I'm taking the deck!"
"Good idea. I need some room to maneuver."
Cannon fire tracked closer. Obi-Wan's cockpit speakers buzzed.
"Cut right, Obi-Wan. Hard right. Don't let them get a handle on you. R2, lock on."
Obi-Wan's starfighter streaked along the curve of the Separatist cruiser's dorsal hull. Anti-fighter flak burst on all sides as the cruiser's guns tried to pick him up. He rolled a right wing over into the service trench that stretched the length of the cruiser's hull. This low and close to the deck, the cruiser's anti-fighter guns couldn't depress their angle of fire enough to get a shot, but the tri-fighter stayed right on his tail. At the far end of the service trench, the massive support buttresses of the cruiser's towering bridge left no room for even Obi-Wan's small craft. He kicked a starfighter into a half-roll that whipped him out of the trench and shot him straight up the tower's angled leading edge. One burst of his underjets jerked him past the forward viewports of the bridge with only meters to spare, and the tri-fighter followed his path exactly. "Of course," he muttered. "That would have been too easy. Anakin, where are you?" One of the control surfaces on his left wing shattered in a burst of plasma. It felt like being shot in the arm. He toggled switches, fighting the yoke. R4P17 shrilled at him. Obi-Wan keyed internal comm. "Don't try to fix it, R4. I've shut it down."
"I have the lock," Anakin said. "Go! Firing now!"
Obi-Wan hit maximum drag on his intact wing, and his starfighter shot into a barely controlled arc, high and right, as Anakin's cannons vaporized the last tri-fighter. Obi-Wan fired retros to stall his starfighter in the blind spot behind the Separatist cruiser's bridge. He hung there for a few seconds to get his breathing and heart under control. "Thanks, Anakin. Thanks. That's all."
"Don't thank me. It was R2 shooting."
"Yes, I suppose, if you like, you can thank your droid for me as well. And Anakin?"
"Yes, Master."
"Next time, you're the bait." This is Obi-Wan Kenobi. A phenomenal pilot who doesn't like to fly. A devastating warrior who'd rather not fight. A negotiator without peer who frankly prefers to sit alone in a quiet cave and meditate. Jedi Master, General in the Grand Army of the Republic, member of the Jedi Council. And yet, inside, he feels like he's none of these things. Inside, he still feels like a Padawan. It is a truism of the Jedi Order that a Jedi Knight's education truly begins only when he becomes a Master. That everything important about being a Master is learned from one student. Obi-Wan feels the truth of this every day. He sometimes dreams of when he was a Padawan in fact, as well as feeling. He dreams that his own master, Qui-Gon Jinn, did not die at the plasma fuel generator core in Theed. He dreams that his master's wise guiding hand is still with him. But Qui-Gon's death is an old pain, one with which he long ago came to terms. A Jedi does not cling to the past. And Obi-Wan Kenobi knows, too, that to have lived his life without being master to Anakin Skywalker would have left him a different man, a lesser man. Anakin has taught him so much. Obi-Wan sees so much of Qui-Gon in Anakin that sometimes it hurts his heart. At the very least, Anakin mirrors Qui-Gon's flair for the dramatic and his casual disregard for rules. Training Anakin and fighting beside him all these years has unlocked something inside Obi-Wan. It's as though Anakin has rubbed off on him a bit and has loosened that clenched jaw insistence on absolute correctness that Qui-Gon always said was his greatest flaw. Obi-Wan Kenobi has learned to relax. He smiles now and sometimes even jokes and has become known for the wisdom gentle humor can provide. Though he does not know it, his relationship with Anakin has molded him into the great Jedi Qui-Gon always said he might someday be. It is characteristic of Obi-Wan that he is entirely unaware of this. Being named to the Council came as a complete surprise. Even now, he is sometimes astonished by the faith the Jedi Council has in his abilities and the credit they give to his wisdom. Greatness was never his ambition. He wants only to perform whatever task he is given to the best of his ability. He is respected throughout the Jedi Order for his insight as well as his warrior skill. He has become the hero of the next generation of Padawans. He is the Jedi their masters hold up as a model. He is the being that the Council assigns to their most important missions. He is modest, centered, and always kind. He is the ultimate Jedi, and he is proud to be Anakin Skywalker's best friend. R2, where's that signal? From its socket beside the cockpit, R2-D2 whistled and beeped. A translation spidered across Anakin's console readout. Scanning. Lots of ECM signal jamming. Keep on it. He glanced at Obi-Wan's starfighter, limping through the battle, 100 meters off his left wing. I can feel his jitters from all the way over here. A tootle, which translated on the readout as, "A Jedi is always calm." He won't think it's funny. Neither do I. Less joking, more scanning. For Anakin Skywalker, starfighter battles were usually as close to fun as he ever came. This one wasn't. Not because of the overwhelming odds or the danger he was in. He didn't care about odds, and he didn't think of himself as being in any particular danger. A few wings of droid fighters didn't much scare a man who'd been a pod racer since he was 6 and had won the Boonta Cup at 9. Who was, in fact, the only human to ever finish a pod race, let alone win one. In those days, he had used the Force without knowing it. He'd thought the Force was something inside him, just a feeling, an instinct, a string of lucky guesses that led him through maneuvers other pilots wouldn't dare attempt. Now, though, now, he could reach into the Force and feel the engagement throughout Coruscant space as though the whole battle were happening inside his head. His vehicle became his body. The pulses of its engines were the beat of his own heart. Flying, he could forget about his slavery, about his mother, about Geonosis and Jabim, Arganar and Munalinst, and all the catastrophes of this brutal war, about everything that had been done to him. And everything he had done. He could even put aside, for as long as the battle roared around him, the starfire of his love for the woman who waited for him on the world below. The woman whose breath was his only air, whose heartbeat was his only music, whose face was the only beauty his eyes would ever see. He could put all this aside because he was a Jedi, because it was time to do a Jedi's work. But today was different. Today wasn't about dodging lasers and blasting droids. Today was about the life of the man who might as well have been his father. A man who could die if the Jedi didn't reach him in time. Anakin had been late once before. Obi-Wan's voice came over the cockpit speakers, flat and tight.
Does your droid have anything? R4's hopeless. I think that last cannon hit cooked his motivator.
Anakin could see exactly the look on his former master's face. A mask of calm, belied by a jaw so tight that when he spoke, his mouth barely moved. Don't worry, Master. If his beacon's working, R2 will find it. Have you thought about how we'll find the Chancellor if...
No.
Obi-Wan sounded absolutely certain.
There's no need to consider it. Until the possible becomes actual, it is only a distraction. Be mindful of what is, not what might be.
Anakin had to stop himself from reminding Obi-Wan that he wasn't a Padawan anymore. I should have been here, he said through his teeth. I told you, I should have been here.
Anakin, he was defended by Stassa Lee and Shakti. If two masters could not prevent this, do you think you could? Stassa Lee is clever and valiant, and Shaak Ti is the most cunning Jedi I've ever met. She's even taught me a few tricks.
Anakin assumed he was supposed to be impressed. But General Grievous...
Master Ti had faced him before, Anakin. After Moonalinst, she is not only subtle and experienced, but very capable indeed. Seats on the Jedi Council aren't handed out as party favors.
I've noticed. He let it drop. The middle of a space battle was no place to get into this particular sore subject. If only he'd been here, instead of Shaak Ti and Stassa Lee, council members or not. If he had been here, Chancellor Palpatine would be home and safe already. Instead, Anakin had been stuck running around the Outer Rim for months like some useless Padawan, and all Palpatine had for protectors were Jedi who were clever and subtle. Clever and subtle. He could whip any 10 clever and subtle Jedi with his lightsaber tied behind his back. But he knew better than to say so.
Put yourself in the moment, Anakin. Focus.
Copy that, Master, Anakin said dryly. Focusing now. R2-D2 twittered, and Anakin checked his console readout. We've got him, Master. The cruiser, dead ahead. That's Grievous's flagship. Invisible Hand.
Anakin, there are dozens of cruisers dead ahead.
It's the one crawling with vulture fighters. The vulture fighters, clinging to the long curves of the Trade Federation cruiser, indicated by Palpatine's beacon, gave it eerily lifelike ripples, like some metallic marine predator, bristling with Alderaanian walking barnacles.
Oh, that one.
He could practically hear Obi-Wan's stomach dropping.
Oh, this should be easy.
Now some of them stripped themselves from the cruiser, ignited their drives, and came looping toward the two Jedi. Easy? No. But it might be fun. Sometimes a little teasing was the only way to get Obi-Wan to loosen up. Lunch at Dex's says I'll blast two for each of yours. R2 can keep score.
Anakin.
All right. Dinner. And I promise this time I won't let R2 cheat.
No games, Anakin. There's too much at stake.
There. That was the tone Anakin had been looking for. A slightly scolding, schoolmasterish edge. Obi-Wan was back on form.
Have your droid tightbeam a report to the temple, and send out a call for any Jedi and starfighters. We'll come at it from all sides.
Way ahead of you. But when he checked his comm readout, he shook his head. There's still too much ECM. R2 can't raise the temple. I think the only reason we can even talk to each other is that we're practically side by side.
And Jedi beacons?
No joy, Master. Anakin's stomach clenched, but he fought the tension out of his voice. We may be the only two Jedi out here.
Then we will have to be enough. Switching to clone fighter channel.
Anakin spun his comm dial to the new frequency, in time to hear Obi-Wan say,
Oddball, do you copy? We need help.
The clone captain's helmet speaker flattened the humanity out of his voice.
Copy, Red Leader. Mark my position and form your squad behind me. We're going in. On our way.
The droid fighters had lost themselves against the background of the battle, but R2-D2 was tracking them on scan. Anakin shifted his grip on his starfighter's control yoke. 10 vultures inbound, high and left to my orientation. More on the way.
I have them. Anakin, wait. The cruiser's bay shields have dropped. I'm reading 4. No, 6 ships incoming.
Obi-Wan's voice rose.
Tri-fighters, coming in fast.
Anakin's smile tightened. This was about to get interesting. Tri-fighters first, Master. The vultures can wait.
Agreed. Slip back and right. Swing behind me. We'll take them on the slant.
Let Obi-Wan go first? With a blown left control surface and a half-crippled R-unit? With Palpatine's life at stake? Not likely. Negative, Anakin said. I'm going head-to-head. See you on the far side.
Take it easy. Wait for Oddball and Squad 7. Anakin...
He could hear the frustration in Obi-Wan's voice as he kicked his starfighter's sublights and surged past. His former master still hadn't gotten used to not being able to order Anakin around.
Not that Anakin had ever been much for following orders, Obi-Wan's or anyone else's.
Sorry we're late.
The digitized voice of the clone whose call sign was Oddball sounded as calm as if he were ordering dinner.
We're on your right, Red Leader. Where's Red Five?
Anakin, form up!
But Anakin was already streaking to meet the Trade Federation fighters.
Incoming!
Obi-Wan's familiar sigh came clearly over the comm. Anakin knew exactly what the Jedi Master was thinking. The same thing he was always thinking. He still has much to learn. Anakin's smile thinned to a grim straight line as enemy starfighters swarmed around him, and he thought the same thing he always thought. We'll see about that. He gave himself to the battle, and his starfighter whirled, and his cannons hammered, and droids on all sides began to burst into clouds of debris and superheated gas. This was how he relaxed. This is Anakin Skywalker, the most powerful Jedi of his generation, perhaps of any generation, the fastest, the strongest, an unbeatable pilot, an unstoppable warrior. On the ground, in the air, or sea, or space, there is no one even close. He has not just power, not just skill, but dash. That rare, invaluable combination of boldness and grace. He is the best there is at what he does, the best there has ever been, and he knows it. HoloNet features call him the hero with no fear. And why not? What should he be afraid of? Except. Fear lives inside him anyway, chewing away the firewalls around his heart. Anakin sometimes thinks of the dread that eats at his heart as a dragon. Children on Tatooine tell each other of the dragons that live inside the suns. Smaller cousins of the sun dragons are supposed to live inside the fusion furnaces that power everything from starships to pod racers. But Anakin's fear is another kind of dragon. A cold kind. A dead kind. Not nearly dead enough. Not long after he became Obi-Wan's Padawan, all those years ago, a minor mission had brought them to a dead system, one so immeasurably old that its star had long ago turned to a frigid dwarf of hyper-compacted trace metals, hovering a quantum fraction of a degree above absolute zero. Anakin couldn't even remember what the mission might have been, but he'd never forgotten that dead star. It had scared him. Stars can die? It is the way of the universe. Which is another manner of saying that it is the will of the Force, Obi-Wan had told him. Everything dies. In time, even stars burn out. This is why Jedi form no attachments. All things pass. To hold on to something or someone beyond its time is to set your selfish desires against the Force. That is a path of misery, Anakin. The Jedi do not walk it. That is the kind of fear that lives inside Anakin Skywalker, the dragon of that dead star. It is an ancient, cold, dead voice within his heart that whispers, "All things die." In bright day, he can't hear it. Battle, a mission, even a report before the Jedi Council can make him forget it's even there. But at night, the walls he has built sometimes start to frost over. Sometimes they start to crack. At night, the Dead Star Dragon sometimes sneaks through the cracks and crawls up into his brain and chews at the inside of his skull. The dragon whispers of what Anakin has lost and what he will lose. The dragon reminds him every night of how he held his dying mother in his arms, of how she had spent her last strength to say, "I knew you would come for me, Anakin." The dragon reminds him every night that someday he will lose Obi-Wan, he will lose Padme, or they will lose him. All things die, Anakin Skywalker. Even stars burn out. And the only answers he ever has for these dead, cold whispers are his memories of Obi-Wan's voice, or Yoda's. But sometimes, he can't quite remember them. All things die. He can barely even think about it.
But right now he doesn't have a choice. The man he flies to rescue is a closer friend than he'd ever hoped to have. That's what puts the edge in his voice when he tries to make a joke. That's what flattens his mouth and tightens the burn scar high in his right cheek. The Supreme Chancellor has been family to Anakin. Always there, always caring, always free with advice and unstinting aid. A sympathetic ear, and a kindly, loving, unconditional acceptance of Anakin exactly as he is. The sort of acceptance Anakin could never get from another Jedi, not even from Obi-Wan. He can tell Palpatine things he could never share with his master. He can tell Palpatine things he can't even tell Padme. Now, the Supreme Chancellor is in the worst kind of danger, and Anakin is on his way, despite the dread boiling through his blood. That's what makes him a real hero. Not the way the Holonet labels him. Not without fear, but stronger than fear. He looks the dragon in the eye and doesn't even slow down. If anyone can save Palpatine, Anakin will. Because he's already the best, and he's still getting better. But locked away behind the walls of his heart, the dragon that is his fear coils and squirms and hisses. Because his real fear, in a universe where even stars can die, is that being the best will never be quite good enough. Obi-Wan's starfighter jolted sideways. Anakin whipped by him and used his forward attitude jets to kick himself into a skew flip, facing backward to blast the last of the tri-fighters on his tail. Now, there were only vulture droids left. A lot of vulture droids.
Did you like that one, Master?
Very pretty. Obi-Wan's cannon stitched plasma across the hull of a swooping vulture fighter until the droid exploded. But we're not through yet.
Watch this.
Anakin flipped his starfighter again and dived, spinning directly through the flock of vulture droids. Their drives blazed as they came around. He led them streaking for the upper deck of a laser-scarred Separatist cruiser.
I'm going to lead them through the needle.
Don't lead them anywhere. Obi-Wan's threat display tallied the vultures on Anakin's tail. 12 of them. 12. First Jedi principle of combat. Survive.
No choice.
Anakin slipped his starfighter through the storm of cannon fire.
Come down and thin them out a little.
Obi-Wan slammed his control yoke forward, as though jamming it against its impact rest would push his battered fighter faster in pursuit. Nothing fancy, awful. As though the damaged droid were even capable of anything fancy. Just hold me steady. He reached into the Force and felt for his shot. On my mark, break left. Now! The shutdown control surface of his left wing turned the left brake into a tight overhead spiral that traversed Obi-Wan's guns across the paths of four vultures. Flash, 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 flash. And all four were gone. He flew on through the clouds of glowing plasma. He couldn't waste time going around. Anakin still had 8 of them on his tail. And what was this? Obi-Wan frowned. The cruiser looked familiar. The needle, he thought. Oh, please say you're kidding. Anakin's starfighter skimmed only meters above the cruiser's dorsal hull. Cannon misses from the vulture fighter swooping toward him blasted chunks out of the cruiser's armor. Okay, R2, where's that trench? His forward screen lit with a topograph of the cruiser's hull. Just ahead lay the trench that Obi-Wan had led the tri-fighter into. Anakin flipped his starfighter through a razor-sharp wing over down past the rim. The walls of the service trench flashed past him as he streaked for the bridge tower at the far end. From here, he couldn't even see the minuscule slit between its support struts. With 8 vulture droids in pursuit, he'd never pull off a slant up the tower's leading edge as Obi-Wan had. But that was all right. He wasn't planning to. His cockpit comm buzzed.
Don't try it, Anakin. It's too tight.
Too tight for you, maybe, Anakin thought. Then said,
I'll get through.
R2-D2 whistled nervous agreement with Obi-Wan.
Easy, R2, Anakin said. We've done this before.
Cannon fire blazed past him, impacting on the support struts ahead. Too late to change his mind now. He was committed. He would bring his ship through, or he would die. Right now, strangely, he didn't actually care which.
Use the Force.
Obi-Wan sounded worried.
Think yourself through, and the ship will follow.
What do you expect me to do? Close my eyes and whistle? Anakin muttered under his breath. Then said aloud,
Copy that.
Thinking now. R2-D2's squeal was as close to terrified as a droid can sound. Glowing letters spidered across Anakin's readout.
Abort! Abort! Abort!
Anakin smiled. Wrong thought. Obi-Wan could only stare open-mouthed as Anakin's starfighter snapped onto its side and scraped through the slit with centimeters to spare. He fully expected one of the struts to knock R2's dome off. The vulture droids tried to follow, but they were just a hair too big. When the first two impacted, Obi-Wan triggered his cannons in a downward sweep. The evasion maneuvers pre-programmed into the vulture fighter's droid brains sent them diving away from Obi-Wan's lasers straight into the fireball expanding from the front of the struts. Obi-Wan looked up to find Anakin soaring straight out from the cruiser with a quick snap roll of victory. Obi-Wan matched his course without the flourish.
I'll give you the first four,
Anakin said over the comm.
But the other eight are mine.
Anakin.
All right. We'll split them.
As they left the cruiser behind, their sensors showed Squad 7 dead ahead. The clone pilots were fully engaged, looping through a dogfight so tight that their ion trails looked like a glowing ball of string.
Oddball's in trouble. I'm going to help him out.
Don't. He's doing his job. We need to do ours.
Master, they're getting eaten alive over.
Every one of them would gladly trade his life for Palpatine's. Will you trade Palpatine's life for theirs?
No. No, of course not, but...
Anakin, I understand. You want to save everyone. You always do. But you can't. Anakin's voice went tight.
Don't remind me.
Head for the command ship. Without waiting for a reply, Obi-Wan targeted the command cruiser and shot away at maximum thrust. The cross of burn scar beside Anakin's eye went pale as he turned his starfighter in pursuit. Obi-Wan was right. He almost always was. You can't save everyone. His mother's body, broken and bloody in his arms, her battered eyes struggling to open, the touch of her smashed lips. I knew you would come to me. I missed you so much. That's what it was to be not quite good enough. It could happen any time, any place. If he was a few minutes late, if he let his attention drift for a single second, if he was a whisker too weak. Any place, any time. But not here, and not now. He forced his mother's face back down below the surface of his consciousness. Time to get to work. They flashed through the battle, dodging flak and turbolaser bolts, slipping around cruisers to eclipse themselves from the sensors of droid fighters. They were only a few dozen kilometers from the command cruiser when a pair of tri-fighters whipped across their path, firing on the deflection. Anakin's sensor board lit up, and R2-D2 shrilled a warning. Missiles! He wasn't worried for himself. The two on his tail were coming at him in perfect tandem. Missiles lacked the sophisticated brains of droid fighters. To keep them from colliding on their inbound vectors, one of them would lock onto his fighter's left drive, the other onto his right. A quick snap roll would make those vectors intersect, which they did in a silent blossom of flame. Obi-Wan wasn't so lucky. The pair of missiles locked onto his sublights weren't precisely side by side. A snap roll would be worse than useless.
Instead, he fired retros and kicked his dorsal jets to half his velocity and knock him a few meters planetward. The lead missile overshot and spiraled off into the orbital battle. The trailing missile came close enough to trigger its proximity sensors and detonated in a spray of glowing shrapnel. Obi-Wan's starfighter flew through the debris, and the shrapnel tracked him. Little silver spheres flipped themselves into his path and latched onto the starfighter's skin, then split and sprouted spidery arrays of jointed arms that pried up hull plates, exposing the starfighter's internal works to multiple circular whorls of blade like ancient mechanical bone saws. This was a problem.
I'm hit.
Obi-Wan sounded more irritated than concerned.
I'm hit.
I have visual.
Anakin swung his starfighter into closer pursuit.
Buzz droids. I count five.
Get out of here, Anakin. There's nothing you can do.
I'm not leaving you, Master.
Cascades of sparks fountained into space from the buzz droid saws.
Anakin, the mission. Get to the command ship. Get the Chancellor.
Not without you,
Anakin said through his teeth. One of the buzz droids crouched beside the cockpit, silvery arms grappling with R4. Another worked on the starfighter's nose, while a third skittered toward the ventral hydraulics. The last two of the aggressive little mechs had spidered to Obi-Wan's left wing, working on that damaged control surface.
You can't help me.
Obi-Wan still maintained his Jedi calm. They're shutting down the controls.
I can fix that.
Anakin brought his starfighter into line only a couple of meters off Obi-Wan's wing.
Steady,
he muttered.
Steady.
And triggered a single burst of his right-side cannon that blasted the two buzz droids into gouts of molten metal, along with most of Obi-Wan's left wing. Anakin said,
whoops.
The starfighter bucked hard enough to knock Obi-Wan's skull against the transparasteel canopy. A gust of stinging smoke filled the cockpit. Obi-Wan fought the yoke to keep a starfighter out of an uncontrolled tumble.
Anakin, that's not helping.
You're right. Bad idea. Here, let's try this. Move left and swing under. Easy.
Anakin, you're too close. Wait.
Obi-Wan stared in disbelief as Anakin's starfighter edged closer and with a dip of its wing, physically slammed a buzz droid into a smear of metal. The impact jolted Obi-Wan again, pounded a deep streak of dent into his starfighter's hull, and shattered the forward control surface of Anakin's wing. Anakin had forgotten the first principle of combat again, as usual.
You're going to get us both killed!
His atmospheric scrubbers drained smoke from the cockpit. But now, the droid on the forward control surface of Obi-Wan's starfighter's right wing had peeled away enough of the hull plates that its jointed saw arms could get deep inside. Sparks flared into space, along with an expanding fountain of gas that instantly crystallized in the hard vacuum. Velocity identical to Obi-Wan's, the shimmering gas hung on his starfighter's nose like a cloud of fog.
Blast, Obi-Wan muttered. I can't see. My controls are going.
You're doing fine. Stay on my wing.
Easier said than done, Obi-Wan thought. Then said,
I have to accelerate out of this.
I'm with you. Go.
Obi-Wan eased power to his thrusters, and his starfighter parted the cloud. But new vapor boiled out to replace it as he went.
Is that last one still on my nose? R4, can you do anything?
The only response he got came from Anakin.
That's a negative on R4. Buzz droid got him.
It.
Obi-Wan corrected automatically.
Wait, they attacked R4?
Not just R4. One of them jumped over when we hit.
Blast,
Obi-Wan thought. They are getting smarter. Through a gap torn in the cloud by the curve of his cockpit, Obi-Wan could see R2-D2 grappling with a buzz droid hand-to-hand. Well, saw-arm to saw-arm. Even flying blind and nearly out of control through the middle of a space battle, Obi-Wan could not avoid a second of disbelief at the bewildering variety of auxiliary tools and aftermarket behaviors Anakin had tinkered onto his starfighter's astromech, even beyond the sophisticated upgrades performed by the Royal Engineers of Naboo. The little device was virtually a partner in its own right. R2's saw cut through one of the buzz droid's grapplers, sending the jointed arm flipping lazily off into space. Then it did the same to another. Then, a panel opened in R2-D2's side, and its data jack arm stabbed out and smacked the crippled buzz droid right off Anakin's hull. The buzz droid spun aft until it was caught in the blast wash of Anakin's sublights, then blew away faster than even Obi-Wan's eye could follow. Obi-Wan reflected that the Separatist droids weren't the only ones that were getting smarter. The data jack retracted, and a different panel opened, this time in R2-D2's dome. A claw cable shot from it into the cloud of gas that still billowed from Obi-Wan's right forward wing, and pulled back out, dragging a struggling buzz droid. The silver droid twisted and squirmed, and its grapplers took hold of the cable, climbing back along it, saw arms waving until Anakin popped the starfighter's underjets and R2 cut the cable and the buzz droid dropped away, tumbling helplessly through the battle. "You know," Obi-Wan said, "I begin to understand why you speak of R2 as though he's a living creature."
"Do you?"
He could hear Anakin smile.
"Don't you mean it?"
"Ah, yes," he frowned. "Yes, of course, it. Thank it for me, will you?"
"Thank him yourself."
"Ah, yes. Thanks, R2." The whistle that came back over the comm had a clear flavor of, "You're welcome." Then the last of the fog finally dispersed, and the sky ahead was full of ship. More than 1 kilometer from end to end, the vast command cruiser filled his visual field. At this range, all he could see were savannas of sand-colored hull, studded with turbo-laser mountains that lit up space with thunderbolts of disintegrating energy. And that immense ship was getting bigger, fast. "Anakin, we're going to collide."
"That's the plan. Head for the hangar."
"That's not..."
"I know. First Jedi principle of..."
"No, it's not going to work. Not for me."
"What?"
"My controls are gone. I can't head for anything."
"Oh. Well, all right. No problem."
"No problem." Then his starfighter clanged as if he'd crashed into a ship-sized gong. Obi-Wan jerked and twisted his head around to find the other starfighter just above his tail. Literally, just above. Anakin's left lead control surface was barely a handspan from Obi-Wan's sublight thrusters. Anakin had hit him on purpose. Then he did it again. Clang. "What are you doing?"
"Just giving you..."
Anakin's voice came slow, tight with concentration.
"A little help with your steering."
Obi-Wan shook his head. This was completely impossible. No other pilot would even attempt it. But for Anakin Skywalker, the completely impossible had an eerie way of being merely difficult. He reflected that he should be used to it by now. While these thoughts chased each other aimlessly through his mind, he had been staring bleakly at a blue shimmer of energy filling the yawning hangar bay ahead. Belatedly, he registered what he was looking at. He thought, "Oh, this is bad." "Anakin," Obi-Wan began. He tried rerouting control paths through his yoke. No luck. Anakin drew up and tipped his forward surfaces down behind the sparking scrap that used to be R4. "Anakin!"
"Give me just a second, Master."
Anakin's voice had gone even tighter. A muffled thump, then another, louder, and a scrape and a squeal of ripping metal.
"This isn't quite as easy as it looks."
"Anakin!"
"What?"
"The hangar bay."
"What about it?"
"Have you noticed that the shield's still up?"
"Really?"
"Really. Not to mention so close that Obi-Wan could practically taste it."
Oh, sorry. I've been busy.
Obi-Wan closed his eyes. Reaching into the Force, his mind followed the starfighter's mangled circuitry to locate and activate the sublight engine's manual test board. With a slight push, he triggered a command normally used only in bench tests. Full reverse. The cometary tail of glowing debris shed by his disintegrating starfighter shot past him and evaporated in a cascade of miniature starbursts on contact with the hangar shield, which was exactly what was about to happen to him. The only effect of full reverse from his failing engines was to give him more time to see it coming. Then Anakin's starfighter swooped in front of him, crossing left to right at a steep deflection. Energy flared from his cannons, and the shield emitters at the right side of the hangar door exploded into scrap. The blue shimmer of the base shield flickered, faded, and vanished, just as Obi-Wan came spinning across the threshold and slammed along the deck, trailing sparks and a scream of tortured metal. His entire starfighter, what was left of it, vibrated with the roar of atmosphere howling out from the unshielded bay. Massive blast doors ground together like jaws. Another force touch on the manual test board cut power to his engines, but he couldn't trigger the explosive bolts on his cockpit canopy. And he had a bad feeling that those canopy bolts were the only thing on his craft that weren't about to explode. His lightsaber found his hand and blue energy flared. One swipe and the canopy burst away, ripped into space by the hurricane of escaping air. Obi-Wan flipped himself up into the stunningly cold gale and let it blow him tumbling away as the remnants of his battered craft finally exploded. He rode the shockwave while he let the Force right him in the air. He landed cat-footed on the blackened streak, still hot enough to scorch his boots, that his landing had gouged into the deck. The hangar was full of battle droids. His shoulders dropped and his knees bent, and his lightsaber came up to angle in front of his face. There were far too many for him to fight alone, but he didn't mind. At least he was out of that blasted starfighter. Anakin slipped his craft toward the hangar through a fountain of junk and flash-frozen gas. One last touch of the yoke twisted his starfighter through the closing teeth of the blast doors just as Obi-Wan's canopy went the other way. Obi-Wan's ship was a hunk of glowing scrap, punctuating a long smoking skid mark. Obi-Wan himself, beard rimed with frost, lightsaber out and flaming, stood in a tightening ring of battle droids. Anakin slewed his starfighter into a landing that scattered droids with the particle blast from his sublight thrusters, and for one second, he was 9 years old again, behind the controls of a starfighter in the Feed Royal hangar, his first touch of a real ship's real cannons blasting battle droids. He'd have done the same right here, except that Palpatine was somewhere on the ship. They just might need one of the light shuttles in this hangar to get the Chancellor safely to the surface. A few dozen cannon blasts bouncing around in here could wreck them all. This he'd have to do by hand. One touch blew his canopy and he sprang from the cockpit, flipping upward to stand on the wing. Battle droids opened fire instantly, and Anakin's lightsaber flashed. R2, locate a computer link. The little droid whistled at him, and Anakin allowed himself a tight smile. Sometimes he thought he could almost understand the droid's electrosonic code. Don't worry about us. Find Palpatine. Go on. I'll cover you. R2 popped out of its socket and bounced to the deck. Anakin jumped ahead of it into a cascade of blaster fire and let the Force direct his blade. Battle droids began to spark and collapse. Get to that link! Anakin had to shout above the whine of blasters and the roar of exploding droids. I'm going for Obi-Wan! No need. Anakin whirled to find Obi-Wan right behind him in the act of slicing neatly through the brain case of a battle droid. I appreciate the thought, Anakin, the Jedi Master said with a gentle smile. But I've already come for you. This, then, is Obi-Wan and Anakin. They are closer than friends, closer than brothers. Though Obi-Wan is 16 standard years Anakin's elder, they have become men together. Neither can imagine life without the other. The war has forged their two lives into one. The war that has done this is not the Clone Wars. Obi-Wan and Anakin's war began on Naboo, when Qui-Gon Jinn died at the hand of a Sith Lord. Master and Padawan and Jedi Knights together, they have fought this war for 13 years. Their war is their life, and their life is a weapon. Say what you will about the wisdom of ancient Master Yoda, or the deadly skill of Grim Mace Windu, the courage of Ki-Adi-Mundi, or the subtle wiles of Shakti. The greatness of all these Jedi is unquestioned, but it pales next to the legend that has grown around Kenobi and Skywalker. They stand alone. Together, they are unstoppable, unbeatable. They are the ultimate go-to guys of the Jedi Order. When the good guys absolutely, positively have to win, the call goes out. Obi-Wan and Anakin always answer. Whether Obi-Wan's legendary cleverness might beat Anakin's raw power, straight up, no rules, is the subject of schoolyard fistfights, creche pool wriggle matches, and pod chamber stink wars across the Republic. These struggles always end somehow, with the combatants on both sides admitting that it doesn't matter. Anakin and Obi-Wan would never fight each other. They couldn't. They're a team. They're the team. And both of them are sure they always will be.
Chapter 2. Dooku.
The storm of blaster fire ricocheting through the hangar bay suddenly ceased. Clusters of battle droids withdrew behind ships and slipped out hatchways. Obi-Wan's familiar grimace showed past his blade as he let it shrink away. I hate it when they do that. Anakin's lightsaber was already back on his belt. When they do what? Disengage and fall back for no reason. There's always a reason, Master. Obi-Wan nodded. That's why I hate it. Anakin looked at the litter of smoking droid parts scattered throughout the hangar bay, shrugged, and snugged his black glove. R2, where's the Chancellor? The little droid's data jack rotated in the wall socket. Its hollow projector eye swiveled, and the blue scanning laser built a ghostly image near Anakin's boot. Palpatine, shackled into a large swivel chair. Even in the tiny translucent blur, he looked exhausted and in pain, but alive. Anakin's heart thumped once, painfully against his ribs. He wasn't too late. Not this time. He dropped to one knee and squinted at the image. Palpatine looked as if he'd aged 10 years since Anakin had last seen him. Muscle bulged along the young Jedi's jaw. If Grievous had hurt the Chancellor, had so much as touched him. The hand of jointed durasteel inside his black glove clenched so hard that electronic feedback made his shoulder ache. Obi-Wan spoke from above that shoulder. Do you have a location? The image rippled and twisted into a schematic map of the cruiser. Far up, at the top of the conning spire, R2 showed a pulsar of brighter blue. In the General's quarters, Obi-Wan scowled. Any sign of Grievous himself? The pulsar shifted to the cruiser's bridge. And guards? The hollow image rippled again, and transformed into an image of the cruiser's General's quarters once more. Palpatine appeared to be alone. The chair sat in the center of an arc of empty floor, facing a huge curved viewing wall. Anakin muttered, "That doesn't make sense." "Of course it does. It's a trap." Anakin barely heard him. He stared down at his black-gloved fist. He opened his fist, closed it, opened it again. The ache from his shoulder flowed down to the middle of his bicep and didn't stop. His elbow sizzled. And his forearm. His wrist had been packed with red-hot gravel, and his hand was on fire. But it wasn't his hand, or his wrist, or his forearm, or his elbow. It was a creation of jointed durasteel and electrodrivers. Anakin? Anakin's lips drew back from his teeth. It hurts. What? Your replacement arm? When did you have it equipped with pain sensors?
I didn't. That's the point.
The pain is in your mind, Anakin.
No.
Anakin's heart froze over. His voice went cold as space.
I can feel him.
Him?
Dooku. He's here. Here on the ship.
Ah. Obi-Wan nodded. I'm sure he is.
You knew?
I guessed. Do you think Grievous couldn't have found Palpatine's beacon? It can hardly be accident that through all the ECM, the Chancellor's homing signal was in the clear.
This is a trap. A Jedi trap.
Obi-Wan laid a warm hand upon Anakin's shoulder, and his face was as grim as Anakin had ever seen it.
Possibly a trap set for us.
Personally.
Anakin's jaw tightened. You're thinking of how he tried to recruit you on Geonosis, before he sent you down for execution.
It's not impossible that we will again face that choice.
It's not a choice.
Anakin rose. His Durasteel hand clenched and stayed that way, a centimeter from his lightsaber.
Let him ask. My answer is right here on my belt.
Be mindful, Anakin. The Chancellor's safety is our only priority.
Yes.
Yes, of course. The ice in Anakin's chest thawed.
All right. It's a trap. Next move?
Obi-Wan allowed himself a bit of a smile of his own as he headed for the nearest exit from the hangar bay.
Same as always, my young friend. We spring it.
I can work with this plan. Anakin turned to his astromech.
You stay here, R2.
The little droid interrupted him with a wheedling whir.
No arguments. Stay. I mean it.
R2-D2's whistling reply had a distinctly sulky tone.
Listen, R2, someone has to maintain computer contact. Do you see a data jack anywhere on me?
The droid seemed to acquiesce, but not before weeping what sounded like it might have been a suggestion where to look. Waiting by the open hatchway, Obi-Wan shook his head.
Honestly, the way you talk to that thing.
Anakin started toward him.
Careful, Master. You'll hurt his feelings.
He stopped in his tracks, a curious look on his face, as if he was trying to frown and to smile at the same time.
Anakin?
He didn't answer.
He couldn't answer.
He was looking at an image inside his head. Not an image. A reality. A memory of something that hadn't happened yet. He saw Count Dooku on his knees. He saw lightsabers crossed at the Count's throat.
Clouds lifted from his heart. Clouds of Jabim, of Arganar, of Kamino, of even the Tusken camp.
For the first time in too many years, he felt young. As young as he really was. Young and free and full of light.
Master?
His voice seemed to be coming from someone else. Someone who hadn't seen what he'd seen. Hadn't done what he'd done.
Master, right here, right now, you and I.
Yes?
Anakin blinked. I think we're about to win the war.
The vast semisphere of the view wall bloomed with battle. Sophisticated sensor algorithms compressed the combat that sprawled throughout the galactic capital's orbit to a view the naked eye could enjoy. Cruisers, hundreds of kilometers apart, exchanging fire at near light speed, appeared to be practically hull to hull, joined by pulsing cables of flame. Turbo laser blasts became swift shafts of light that shattered into prismatic splinters against shields, or bloomed into miniature supernovae that swallowed ships whole. The invisible gnat clouds of starfighter dogfights became a gleaming dance of shadow moths at the end of Coruscant's brief spring. Within that immense curve of computer-filtered carnage, the only furnishing was one lone chair, centered in an expanse of empty floor. This was called the General's Chair, just as this apartment atop the flagship's conning spire was called the General's Quarters. With his back to that chair and to the man shackled within it, hands folded behind him beneath his cloak of silken armor weave, stood Count Dooku. Stood Darth Tyrannus, Lord of the Sith. He looked upon his master's handiwork, and it was good. More than good, it was magnificent. Even the occasional tremor of the deck beneath his boots, as the entire ship shuddered under enemy torpedo and turbo laser blasts, felt to him like applause. Behind him sounded the initiating hum of the intership holocom, which crackled into a voice, both electronic and oddly expressive, as though a man spoke through a droid's electrosonic vocabulator.
Lord Tyrannus, Kenobi and Skywalker have arrived.
Yes. Dooku had felt them both in the Force. Drive them toward me.
My lord, I must express once more my objections.
Dooku turned. From his commanding height, he stared down at the blue-scanned hollow image of Invisible Hand's commander.
Your objections have been noted already, General. Leave the Jedi to me.
But driving them to you also sends them directly toward the Chancellor himself. Why does he remain on this ship at all? He should be hidden. He should be guarded. We should have had him out-system hours ago.
Matters are so, Count Dooku said, because Lord Sidious wishes them so. Should you desire to press your objections, please feel at liberty to take them up with him.
I don't believe that will be necessary.
Very well, then. Confine your efforts to preventing support troops from boarding. Without their pet clones to back them up, no Jedi is a danger to me.
The deck shuddered again, more sharply, followed by a sudden shift in the vector of the cruiser's artificial gravity that would have sent a lesser man stumbling. With the Force to maintain, the dignified solidity of his posture, the effect on Dooku was confined to the lift of one eyebrow.
And may I suggest that you devote some attention to protecting this ship? Having it destroyed with both you and me aboard might put something of a cramp in the war effort, don't you think?
It is already being done, my lord. Does my lord wish to observe the progress of the Jedi? I can feed the security monitors onto this channel.
Thank you, General. That will be welcome.
Gracious as ever, my lord. Grievous out.
Count Dooku allowed himself a near-invisible smile. His inviolable courtesy, the hallmark of a true aristocrat, was effortless. Yet somehow it seemed always to impress the common rabble, as well as those with the intellect of common rabble, regardless of accomplishment or station. Like, for example, that repulsive cyborg Grievous. He sighed. Grievous had his uses. Not only was he an able field commander, but he would soon make a marvelous scapegoat upon whom to hang every atrocity of this sadly necessary war. Someone had to take that particular fall, and Grievous was just the creature for the job. It certainly would not be Dooku. This was, in fact, one purpose of the cataclysmic battle outside, but not the only one. The blue-scanned image before him now became miniatures of Kenobi and Skywalker as he had seen them so many times before, shoulder to shoulder, lightsabers whirling as they enthusiastically dismantled droid after droid after droid, feeling as if they were winning, while in truth they were being chivied exactly where the Lords of the Sith wanted them to go. Such children they were. Dooku shook his head. It was almost too easy. This is Dooku, Darth Tyrannus, Count of Sereno. Once a great Jedi Master, now an even greater Lord of the Sith, Dooku is a dark colossus bestriding the galaxy, nemesis of the corrupt Republic. Or a flam of the principled Confederacy of Independent Systems, he is the very personification of shock and awe. He was one of the most respected and powerful Jedi in the Order's 25,000-year history. Yet at the age of 70, Dooku's principles would no longer allow him to serve a republic in which political power was for sale to the highest bidder. He'd said farewell to his former Padawan, Qui-Gon Jinn, now a legendary master in his own right. He'd said farewell to his close friends on the Jedi Council, Mace Windu, and the ancient Master Yoda. He'd said farewell to the Jedi Order itself. He is numbered among the lost, the Jedi who renounced their fealty to the Order and resigned their commissions of Jedi knighthood in service of ideals higher than even the Order itself professed. The Lost 20, as they have been known since Dooku joined their number, are remembered with both honor and regret among the Jedi. Their images, sculpted from bronzium, stand enshrined in the temple archives. These bronzium images serve as melancholy reminders that some Jedi have needs the Order cannot satisfy. Dooku had retired to his family estate, the planetary system of Sereno. Assuming his hereditary title as its count made him one of the wealthiest beings in the galaxy. Amid the unabashed corruption endemic to the Republic, his immense wealth could have bought the allegiance of any given number of senators. He could perhaps have bought control of the Republic itself. But a man of such heritage, such principle, could never stoop to be lord of a garbage heap, chief of a horde of scavengers squabbling over scraps. The Republic, to him, was nothing more than this. Instead, he used all the great power of his family fortune and the vastly greater power of his unquestioned integrity to begin the cleansing of the galaxy from the fester of this so-called democracy. He is the icon of the separatist movement, its public face. He is to the Confederacy of Independent Systems what Palpatine is to the Republic, the living symbol of the justice of its cause. This is the public story. This is the story that even Dooku, in his weaker moments, almost believes. The truth is more complicated. Dooku is different. He doesn't remember quite when he discovered this. It may have been when he was a young Padawan, betrayed by another learner who had claimed to be his friend. Lorian Nod had said it to his face. "You don't know what friendship is." And he didn't. He had been angry, certainly, furious that his reputation had been put at risk. And he had been angry at himself for his error in judgment, trusting as an ally one who was in fact an enemy. The most astonishing part of the whole affair had been that even after turning on him before the Jedi, the other boy had expected him to participate in a lie in the name of their friendship. It had been all so preposterous that he hadn't known how to reply. In fact, he has never been entirely sure what beings mean when they speak of friendship. Love, hate, joy, anger. Even when he can feel the energy of these emotions in others, they translate in his perception to other kinds of feelings. The kinds that make sense. Jealousy, he understands, and possessiveness. He is fierce when any being encroaches on what is rightfully his. Intolerance, at the intractability of the universe and at the undisciplined lives of its inhabitants, this is his normal state. Spite is a recreation. He takes considerable pleasure from the suffering of his enemies. Pride is a virtue in an aristocrat, and indignation his inalienable right. When any dare to impugn his integrity, his honor, or his rightful place atop the natural hierarchy of authority. And moral outrage makes perfect sense to him. When the incorrigibly untidy affairs of ordinary beings refuse to conform to the plainly obvious structure of how society ought to be. He is entirely incapable of caring what any given creature might feel for him. He cares only what that creature might do for him or to him. Very possibly. He is what he is because other beings just aren't very interesting. Or even, in a sense, entirely real. For Dooku, other beings are mostly abstractions. Simple schematic sketches who fall into two essential categories. The first category is assets. Beings who can be used to serve his various interests, such as, for most of his life, and to some extent even now, the Jedi. Particularly Mace Windu and Yoda, both of whom had regarded him as their friend for so long that it had effectively blinded them to the truth of his activities. And of course, for now, the Trade Federation and the Intergalactic Banking Clan, the Techno Union, the Corporate Alliance, and the Weapon Lords of Geonosis, and even the common rabble of the galaxy, who exist largely to provide an audience of sufficient size to do justice to his grandeur. The other category is threats. In this second set, he numbers every sentient being he cannot include in the first. There is no third category. Someday, there may be not even a second. Being considered a threat by Count Dooku is a death sentence. A death sentence he plans to pronounce, for example, on his current allies, the heads of the aforementioned Trade Federation, Intergalactic Banking Clan, Techno Union and Corporate Alliance, and Geonosian Weaponeers. Treachery is the way of the Sith. Count Dooku watched with clinical distaste as the blue-scanned images of Kenobi and Skywalker engaged in a preposterous farce chase, pursued by destroyer droids into and out of turbolift pods that shot upward and downward and even sideways.
"It will be,"
he said slowly, meditatively, as though he spoke only to himself,
"an embarrassment to be captured by him."
The voice that answered him was so familiar that sometimes his very thoughts spoke in it, instead of in his own.
"An embarrassment you can survive, Lord Tyrannis. After all, he is the greatest Jedi alive, is he not? And have we not ensured that all the galaxy shares this opinion?"
"Quite so, my master. Quite so." Again, Dooku sighed. Today he felt every hour of his 83 years.
"It is fatiguing to play the villain for so long, Master. I find myself looking forward to an honorable captivity."
A captivity that would allow him to sit out the rest of the war in comfort. A captivity that would allow him to forswear his former allegiances, when he would conveniently appear to finally discover the true extent of the Separatists' crimes against civilization, and bind himself to the new government with his reputation for integrity and idealism fully intact. The new government. This had been their star of destiny for lo these many years. A government clean, pure, direct. None of the messy scramble for the favor of ignorant rabble and subhuman creatures that made up the Republic he so despised. The government he would serve would be authority personified. Human authority. It was no accident that the primary powers of the Confederacy of Independent Systems were Nymordian, Skakoan, Quarren and Aqualish, Ma'oon and Gossam, Cymerthian and Kuravar and Geonosian. At war's end, the aliens would be crushed, stripped of all they possessed, and their systems and their wealth would be given into the hands of the only beings who could be trusted with them. Human beings. Dooku would serve an empire of man. And he would serve it as only he could, as he was born to. He would smash the Jedi Order to create it anew, not shackled by the corrupt, narcissistic, shabby little beings who called themselves politicians, but free to bring true authority and true peace to a galaxy that so badly needed both. An order
that would not negotiate, would not mediate, an order that would enforce. The survivors of the Jedi Order would become the Sith Army, the fist of the Empire. And that fist would become a power beyond any Jedi's darkest dreams. The Jedi were not the only users of the Force in the galaxy. From Hapes to Harun Kal, from Khifu to Dathomir, powerful Force-capable humans and near-humans had long refused to surrender their children to lifelong bound servitude in the Jedi Order. They would not so refuse the Sith Army. They would not have the choice. Dooku frowned down at the hollow image. Kenobi and Skywalker were going through more low comedy business with another balky turbo lift, possibly Grievous having some fun with the shaft controls, while battle droids haplessly pursued. Really, it was all so undignified. May I suggest, Master, that we give Kenobi one last chance? The support of a Jedi of his integrity would be invaluable in establishing the political legitimacy of our empire.
Ah, yes, Kenobi.
His master's voice went silken.
You have long been interested in Kenobi, haven't you?
Of course. His master was my Padawan. In a sense, he's practically my grandson.
He is too old, too indoctrinated, irretrievably poisoned by Jedi fables. We established that on Geonosis, did we not? In his mind, he serves the Force itself. Reality is nothing in the face of such conviction.
Dooku sighed. He should, he supposed, have no difficulty with this, having ordered the Jedi Master's death once already. True enough, I suppose. How fortunate we are that I never labored under any such illusions.
Kenobi must die today, at your hand. His death may be the code key of the final lock that will seal Skywalker to us forever.
Dooku understood. Not only would the death of his mentor tip Skywalker's already unstable emotional balance down the darkest of slopes, but it would also remove the greatest obstacle to Skywalker's successful conversion. As long as Kenobi was alive, Skywalker would never be securely in the camp of the Sith. Kenobi's unshakable faith in the values of the Jedi would keep the Jedi blindfold on Skywalker's eyes and the Jedi shackles on the young man's true power. Still, though, Dooku had some reservations. This had all come about too quickly. Had Sidious thought through all the implications of this operation? But I must ask my master, is Skywalker truly the man we want?
He is powerful, potentially more powerful than even myself.
Which is precisely, Dooku said meditatively, why it might be best if I were to kill him instead.
Are you so certain that you can?
Please. Of what use is power unstructured by discipline? The boy is as much a danger to himself as he is to his enemies, and that mechanical arm. Dooku's lip curled with cultivated distaste. Revolting.
Then perhaps you should have spared his real arm.
A gentleman would have learned to fight one-handed. Dooku flicked a dismissive wave. He's no longer even entirely human. With Grievous, the use of these bio-droid devices is almost forgivable. He was such a disgusting creature already that his mechanical parts are clearly an improvement. But a blend of droid and human? Appalling. The depths of bad taste. How are we to justify associating with him?
How fortunate I am,
the silk in his master's voice softened further,
to have an apprentice who feels it is appropriate to lecture me.
Dooku lifted an eyebrow.
I have overstepped, my master, he said with his customary grace. I am only observing, not arguing. Not at all.
Skywalker's arm makes him, for our purposes, even better. It is the permanent symbol of the sacrifices he has made in the name of peace and justice. It is a badge of heroism that he must publicly wear for the rest of his life. No one can ever look at him and doubt his honor, his courage, his integrity. He is perfect just as he is. Perfect. The only question that remains is whether he is capable of transcending the artificial limitations of his Jedi indoctrination. And that, my Lord Count, is precisely what today's operation is designed to discover.
Dooku could not argue. Not only had the Dark Lord introduced Dooku to realms of power beyond his most spectacular fantasies, but Sidious was also a political manipulator so subtle that his abilities might be considered to dwarf even the power of the dark side itself. It was said that whenever the Force closes a hatch, it opens a viewport, and every viewport that had so much as cracked in this past 13 standard years had found a Dark Lord of the Sith already at the rim, peering in, calculating how best to slip through. Improving upon his master's plan was near to impossible. His own idea of substituting Kenobi for Skywalker, he had to admit, was only the product of a certain misplaced sentimentality. Skywalker was almost certainly the man for the job. He should be. Darth Sidious had spent a considerable number of years making him so. Today's test would remove the almost. He had no doubt that Skywalker would fall. Dooku understood that this was more than a test for Skywalker, though Sidious had never said so directly. Dooku was certain that he himself was being tested as well. Success today would show his master that he was worthy of the mantle of mastery himself. By the end of the coming battle, he would have initiated Skywalker into the manifold glories of the dark side, just as Sidious had initiated him. He gave no thought to failure. Why should he?
But, forgive me, Master, but Kenobi having fallen to my blade, are you certain Skywalker will ever accept my orders? You must admit that his biography offers little confidence that he is capable of obedience at all.
Skywalker's power brings with it more than mere obedience. It brings creativity and luck. We need never concern ourselves with the sort of instruction that Grievous, for example, requires. Even the blind fools in the Jedi Council see clearly enough to understand this. Even they no longer try to tell him how. They merely tell him what. And he finds a way. He always has.
Dooku nodded. For the first time since Sidious had revealed the true subtlety of this masterpiece, Dooku allowed himself to relax enough to imagine the outcome. With his heroic capture of Count Dooku, Anakin Skywalker will become the ultimate hero, the greatest hero in the history of the Republic, perhaps of the Jedi Order itself. The loss of his beloved partner will add just exactly the correct spice of tragedy to give melancholy weight to his every word when he gives his holonet interviews denouncing the Senate's corruption as impeding the war effort, when he delicately, oh so delicately, not to mention reluctantly, insinuates that corruption in the Jedi Order prolonged the war as well, when he announces the creation of a new order of Force-using warriors. He will be the perfect commanding general for the Sith army.
Dooku could only shake his head in awe. And to think that only days earlier, the Jedi had seemed so close to uncovering, even destroying, all he and his master had worked for.
But he should never have feared. His master never lost.
He would never lose. He was the definition of unbeatable.
How can one defeat an enemy? One thinks is a friend.
And now, with a single brilliant stroke, his master would turn the Jedi Order back upon itself, like an Ithrani Ouroboros devouring its own tail.
This was the day, the hour. The death of Obi-Wan Kenobi would be the death of the Republic. Today would see the birth of the Empire.
Tyrannus, are you well?
Am I? Dooku realized that his eyes had misted. Yes, my master. I am beyond well. Today, the climax, the grand finale, the culmination of all your decades of work, I find myself somewhat overcome.
Compose yourself, Tyrannus. Kenobi and Skywalker are nearly at the door. Play your part, my apprentice, and the galaxy is ours.
Dooku straightened, and for the first time, looked his master in the eyes.
Darth Sidious, Dark Lord of the Sith, sat in the general's chair, shackled to it at the wrist and ankle.
Dooku bowed to him. Thank you, Chancellor.
Palpatine of Naboo, Supreme Chancellor of the Republic, replied, withdraw. They are here.
Chapter 3, The Way of the Sith.
The turbo lift's door whished open. Anakin pressed himself against the wall, a litter of saber-sliced droid parts around his feet. Beyond appeared to be a perfectly ordinary lift lobby, pale and bare and empty. Made it, at last. Anakin's whole body hummed to the tune of his blue-hot blade. Anakin. Obi-Wan stood against the opposite wall. He looked calm in a way Anakin could barely understand. He gave a significant stare down at the lightsaber in Anakin's hand.
Anakin, rescue, he said softly. Not mayhem.
Anakin kept his weapon right where it was.
And Dooku? Once the Chancellor is safe, Obi-Wan said with a ghost of a smile, we can blow up the ship.
Anakin's mechanical fingers tightened until the grip of his lightsaber creaked.
I'd rather do it by hand.
Obi-Wan slipped cautiously through the turbolift's door. Nothing shot at him. He beckoned.
I know this is difficult, Anakin. I know it's personal for you on many levels. You must take extra care to be mindful of your training here. And not only your combat training.
Heat rose in Anakin's cheeks.
I am not
your Padawan anymore, snarled inside his head. But that was adrenaline talking. He bit back the words and said instead,
going to let you down, Master, or Chancellor Palpatine. I have no doubt of that. Just remember that Dooku is no mere dark Jedi like that Ventress woman. He is a Lord of the Sith. The jaws of this trap are about to snap shut, and there may be danger here beyond the merely physical.
Yes. Anakin let his blade shrink away and moved past Obi-Wan into the turbolift lobby. Distant concussions boomed throughout the ship, and the floor rocked like a raft on a river in flood. He barely noticed.
There has been so much. What he's done, not just to the Jedi, but to the galaxy.
Anakin, Obi-Wan began warningly.
Don't worry, I'm not angry, and I'm not looking for revenge.
He lifted his lightsaber. I'm just looking forward to ending it.
Anticipation is distraction, I know. And I know that hope is as hollow as fear.
Anakin let himself smile just a bit.
And I know everything else you're dying to tell me right now.
Obi-Wan's slightly rueful bow of acknowledgement was as affectionate as a hug.
I suppose at some point I will eventually have to stop trying to train you.
Anakin's smile broadened toward a soft chuckle.
I think that's the first time you've ever admitted it.
They stopped at the door to the general's quarters, a huge oval of opalescent iridite chased with gold. Anakin stared at his ghostly, almost reflection while he reached into the room beyond with the Force, and let the Force reach into him. I'm ready, Master. I know you are. They stood a moment, side by side. Anakin didn't look at him. He stared into the door, through the door, searching in its shimmering depths for a hint of an unguessable future. He couldn't imagine not being at war. Anakin. Obi-Wan's voice had gone soft, and his hand was warm on Anakin's arm. There is no other Jedi I would rather have at my side right now. No other man. Anakin turned and found within Obi-Wan's eyes a depth of feeling he had only rarely glimpsed in all their years together, and the pure, uncomplicated love that rose up within him then felt like a promise from the Force itself. I wouldn't have it any other way, Master. I believe, his one-time master said, with a gently humorous look of astonishment at the words coming out of his mouth, that you should get used to calling me Obi-Wan. Obi-Wan? Anakin said. Let's go get the Chancellor. Yes, Obi-Wan said. Let's. Inside a turbolift pod, Dooku watched hologramic images of Kenobi and Skywalker cautiously pick their way down the curving stairs from the entrance balcony to the main level of the General's quarters, moving slowly to stay braced against the pitching of the cruiser. The ship shuddered and bucked with multiple torpedo bursts, and the lights went out again. Lighting was always the first to fail, as power was diverted from life support to damage control.
My lord.
On the intership comm, Grievous sounded actively concerned.
Damage to the ship is becoming severe. 30% of automated weapon systems are down, and we may soon lose hyperspace capability.
Dooku nodded judiciously to himself, frowning down at the translucent blue ghosts slinking toward Palpatine.
Sound the retreat for the entire strike force, General, and prepare the ship for jump. Once the Jedi are dead, I will join you on the bridge.
As my lord commands, Grievous out.
Indeed you are, you vile creature,
Dooku muttered to the dead comlink.
Out of luck and out of time.
He cast the comlink aside and ignored its clatter across the deck. He had no further use for it. Let it be destroyed along with Grievous, those repulsive bodyguards of his, and the rest of the cruiser, once he was safely captured and away. He nodded to the two hulking super battle droids that flanked him. One opened the lift door and they marched through, pivoting to take positions on either side. Dooku straightened his cloak of shimmering armor weave and strode grandly into the half-dark lift lobby. In the pale emergency lighting, the door to the General's quarters still smoldered where those two idiotic peasants had lightsabered it. To pick his way through the hole would risk getting his trousers scorched. Dooku sighed and gestured, and the opalescent wreckage of the door silently slid itself out of his way. He certainly did not intend to fight two Jedi with his pants on fire. Anakin slid along the bank of chairs on one side of the immense situation table that dominated the center of the General's quarters main room. Obi-Wan mirrored him on the opposite side. Silent lightning flashed and flared. The room's sole illumination came from the huge curving view wall at its far end. A storm of turbolaser blasts and flak bursts and the miniature supernovae that were the deaths of entire ships. A stark shadow against that backdrop of carnage, the silhouette of one tall chair. Anakin caught Obi-Wan's eye across the table and nodded toward the dark shape ahead. Obi-Wan replied with the Jedi hand signal for approach with caution and added the signal for be ready for action. Anakin's mouth compressed, like he needed to be told. After all the trouble they'd had with the turbolifts, anything could be up here by now. The place could be full of droidicas, for all they knew. The lights came back on. Anakin froze. The dark figure in the chair. It was Chancellor Palpatine. It was, and there were no droids to be seen. And his heart should have leapt within his chest, but... Palpatine looked bad. The Chancellor looked beyond old, looked ancient like Yoda was ancient, possessed of incomprehensible age, and exhausted and in pain, and worse. Anakin saw in the Chancellor's face something he'd never dreamed he'd find there, and it squeezed breath from his lungs and wiped words from his brain. Palpatine looked frightened. Anakin didn't know what to say. He couldn't imagine what to say. All he could imagine was what Grievous and Dooku must have done to put fear on the face of this brave good man. And that imagining ignited a sizzle in his blood that drew his face tight and clouded his heart and started again the low roll of thunder in his ears. Thunder from Arganar, from Jabim, thunder from the Tusken camp. If Obi-Wan was struck by any similar distress, it was invisible. With his customary grave courtesy, the Jedi Master inclined his head. "Chancellor," he said. A calmly respectful greeting, as though they had met by chance on the grand concourse of the Galactic Senate. Palpatine's only response was a tight murmur. "Anakin, behind you." Anakin didn't turn. He didn't have to. It wasn't just the clack of boot heels and clank of magnapeds crossing the threshold of the entrance balcony. The Force gathered within him and around him in a sudden clench like the fists of a startled man. In the Force, he could feel the focus of Palpatine's eyes, the source of the fear that rolled off him in billows like vapor down a block of frozen air. And he could feel the even colder wave of power, colder than the frost on a Minok's mouth that slid into the room behind him like an ice dagger into his back. Funny, he thought. After Ventress, somehow I always expect the dark side to be hot. Something unlocked in his chest. The thunder in his ears dissolved into red smoke that coiled at the base of his spine. His lightsaber found his hand, and his lips peeled off his teeth in a smile that a crate dragon would have recognized. That trouble he was having with talking went away. "This," he murmured to Palpatine, and to himself, "is not a problem." The voice that spoke from the entrance balcony was an elegant basso, with under notes of oily resonance like a Kryn Oak cavern horn. Count Dooku's voice. "General Kenobi, Anakin Skywalker. Gentlemen, a term I use in its loosest possible sense, you are my prisoners." Now Anakin didn't have any troubles at all. The entrance balcony provided an appropriate angle, far above the Jedi, looking down upon them, for Dooku to make final assessments before beginning the farce. Like all true farce, the coming denouement would proceed with remorseless logic from its ridiculous premise. That Dooku could ever be overcome by mere Jedi. Any Jedi. What a pity his old friend Mace couldn't have joined them today. He had no doubt the Koran Master would have enjoyed the coming show. Dooku had always preferred an educated audience. At least Palpatine was here, shackled within the great chair at the far end of the room. The space battle whirling upon the view wall behind him as though his stark silhouette spread great wings of war. But Palpatine was less audience than he was author. Not at all the same thing. Skywalker gave Dooku only his back, but his blade was already out, and his tall, lean frame stood frozen with anticipation. So motionless, he almost seemed to shiver. Pathetic. It was an insult to call this boy a Jedi at all. Kenobi now. He was something else entirely. A classic of his obsolete kind. He simply stood gazing calmly up at Dooku and the super battle droids that flanked him. Hands open, utterly relaxed. On his face, only an expression of mild interest. Dooku derived a certain melancholy satisfaction, a pleasurably lonely contemplation of his own unrecognized greatness, from a brief reflection that Skywalker would never understand how much thought and planning, how much work Lord Sidious had invested in so hastily orchestrating his sham victory. Nor would he ever understand the artistry, the true mastery that Dooku would wield in his own defeat. But thus was life. Sacrifices must be made for the greater good. There was a war on, after all. He called upon the Force, gathering it to himself and wrapping himself within it. He breathed it in and held it whirling inside his heart, clenching down upon it until he could feel the spin of the galaxy around him. Until he became the axis of the universe. This was the real power of the dark side, the power he had suspected even as a boy, had sought through his long life until Darth Sidious had shown him that it had been his all along. The dark side didn't bring him to the center of the universe, it made him the center. He drew power into his innermost being until the Force itself existed only to serve his will. Now, the scene below subtly altered, though to the physical eye there was no change. Powered by the dark side, Dooku's perception took the measure of those below him with exhilarating precision. Kenobi was luminous, a transparent being, a window onto a sunlit meadow of the Force. Skywalker was a storm cloud, flickering with dangerous lightning, building the rotation that threatens a tornado. And then there was Palpatine, of course. He was beyond power. He showed nothing of what might be within. Though seen with the eyes of the dark side itself, Palpatine was an event horizon. Beneath his entirely ordinary surface was absolute, perfect nothingness. Darkness beyond darkness. A black hole of the Force. And he played his helpless hostage role perfectly. Get help! The edge of panic in his hoarse half-whisper sounded real even to Dooku. You must get help. Neither of you is any match for a Sith Lord. Now Skywalker turned, meeting Dooku's direct gaze for the first time since the abandoned hangar on Geonosis. His reply was clearly intended as much for Dooku as for Palpatine. Tell that to the one Obi-Wan left in pieces on Naboo. Empty bravado. Maul had been an animal, a skilled